wave packets, then I want to return to the Schrodinger equation. So we're in this situation. I have the Schrodinger equation. I d by dt of c equals 1/2 Laplacian c. And I want x to be in Rn. And I'm starting with initial data c0 of x, which is my data cx when time is equal to 0. And I want to choose that to be look like a wave packet. So I want this to be like a wave packet. Because we were just discussing where solutions propagate depending on their group velocity, right? So I'd like to remind you that that for this equation, omega of c is equal to 1/2 mod c squared. I have to worry about the sign. And thus, d by dc of omega is, of course, c. And that's often called the momentum. Although, if you're given an arbitrary function, you take its Fourier transform. We already called that the momentum distribution. But, you know, is it? It takes a certain interpretation to decide is it moving and with what mass and velocity. So then I wrote down, so we had this on the board last time, and we had this on the board right at the very end. And I assigned a problem, okay? And I said, if I give C naught of x in particular form, that is, this is this W, x, and it's parameterized by a k, which is going to be a momentum or a wave number, and it's also parameterized by a, which is going to be a width, basically. And I want that to be the following thing. 1 upon 4th root of pi to the nth power. 1 upon a to the n upon 2. E to the I k dot x. E to the minus x squared upon 2a squared. That's initial data. Then the solution... I plug this into the Schrodinger equation. I have a solution. Okay, then I have a solution, which is in the following form: c of x, t. It's the solution, meaning it's the Schrodinger propagator at time t, starting with wx. I won't write down the parameters. And then had the following form: a factor times e. To the e to the phi. It's not quite a phase function because I put the I. Explicitly, where phi of x is given. Phi is a function of x and t. It's given by some explicit expression. And this factor is given by some explicit expression. So let me give those expressions, and then we'll think about it. Minus 1/2 a squared over a to the 4th plus t squared x minus kt squared plus, I'm going to run out of room, plus I upon 2. A complicated expression. Let's see. There we go. Complicated expression. 2a to the 4th. A to the 4th plus t squared. K dot x plus t over a to the 4th plus t squared. X squared minus a to the 4th k squared. Close. And this expression, too, I'm going to write down, which was... a to the n upon 2 root t plus ia squared over t squared plus a to the fourth to the n. E to the minus I pi upon 4 times n. A to the n upon 2 divided by root, fourth root of pi to the n. Woof! And that's supposed to be a solution. So there's a problem set. And I already got a comment, but there's a problem set, which is check it. Then I said, well, it's not exactly a solution, it's close. So I want to poll, before I go on further, I want to poll you, because I've already had one vote for it's not a solution. So has anyone else, what else do people say? Let's see. I've yeah, because when t is zero, there's some cancellation, and this is supposed to be a factor, not an exponent. A to the n upon 2. So think of this as a unit. Oh, I duplicated it. There we are. So those two go together, and when t is equal to zero, there's cancellation. Okay. Well, so let me say further about somebody says, well, I put it in maple, and it didn't equal zero. But this is for your brain, not for maple. So you certainly can check a formula by maple, but now if it's wrong, it's up to your brain to adjust it a little bit until it is a solution. So I apologize for this. It may be a little glitchy, but I need you to help me. Okay. But this is your students. This is where, and I can tell by your homeworks that as soon as we got to quantum mechanics, everyone has these sophisticated techniques. So these are students who took, a lot of you took quantum mechanics. So you should be experts in this. Okay? I want to think about several things based on this solution or its adjustment to be a solution. It has this general character. Okay? And besides, we shouldn't believe maple more than our own brains. Whoops. You could have put something funny back here. So one thing is, so I want to make comments. So let's do the following thing. I'm going to take my initial data, and I take W out X. Right, I want W, my initial data, W of X, I make squared dx, I integrate everywhere. It's equal to, who did this calculation? It's equal to 1. It's normalized properly. And what does it look like? Well, this is a wave packet, which is a Gaussian. Here's 0, and it's a Gaussian centered around 0 because it's e to the minus x squared over 2a squared of width approximately a. So this is about a. And it's oscillatory. So this is a complex oscillation, which I'm pretending to be real. That's the real part of it. And the imaginary part of it is pi over 2 out of phase. And this width, well, 1 over this width is k. That's the momentum. So that's the initial data. So it's equal to 1, and its absolute value looks like a Gaussian, and it's oscillatory like that. And time evolution gives you what? Well, here's c of x t, the solution, squared dx. That looks as follows. Where is it centered? Where's the center of this thing? C is equal to complicated expression e to the phi. Complicated expression in t, forget it has no x's in it, e to the phi. Phi has a t expression a factor, like a new A, times x minus kt squared, real. So where is its center? At kt. How does it oscillate? Well, it oscillates with an x squared, like a Gaussian, like a complex Gaussian should. And it also has, but when x minus, let's see, this is a t times this is a constant factor, so t over x squared, that's a certain oscillation. But if I just look for x fixed, well, if I look nearby the center, it looks like this. So I claim it's more or less with momentum m at a displaced Gaussian with a displaced center and some oscillation at infinity, which of course is in the tail. And so kt. So in fact, what's its velocity? If it took time t to go take its center from here to here, its velocity, we'll say its momentum, is k. Okay? Those are the basic features. And it's widening, it's spreading out. You look at this factor, which is its width, and as t gets larger, it gets smaller. I guess a is in the denominator, so this is 1 over its width squared. So as t gets large, its width grows. So it's spreading out, and it's moving at velocity k, which you could not even see in this, in the initial probability distribution, moving with velocity k and spreading out. Spreading out according to A. Interesting. So so one of the problem set problems was to prove this. Well, given the comments, maybe I didn't get it exactly right, but I don't want to calculate that in front of you. So calculate it for me. Make sure it's right, and if not, adjust it so it is. Okay? But second, morally, what I want to draw from this is the behavior of solution to the Schrodinger equation. It's one of our operators of real principal type, or operators of real type. So let's look at the moment, the zero moment of p. So this is dp of t, right? A density in x. The zero moments of p, we decided, is equal to 1. How do we know that, by the way? It's initially 1, and we proved a proposition saying it's conserved for the Schrodinger equation. The first moment of p is equal to x mod c of xt squared dx. Just thinking about this a little bit, it has to be kt. And the second moment, well, I want to do the following thing. Actually, I want x minus kt, not the pure second moment, but I want to adjust for the center, c of xt squared dx. Is this factor a to the fourth plus t squared over 2a squared, growing with t. So it gives us a corollary, which is, I've lost track a little bit of my numbering system from last time, but I think it might be corollary 8, but you might check me. Well, I can just start again with 1, because it's a new lecture. Corollary 1. Corollary of nothing, we don't have any result. Anyway, it's corollary. It says the following thing. The kth moment of solutions of, well, I don't want to say solutions, of the probability distributions given from solutions of the Schrodinger equations of dpt of x are not bounded in terms of the moment let me say it this way, the, oh yeah, the moment of dp0 of x. And I want to contrast that with the heat equation case. Because what happened in terms of the heat equation? You could write down a formula. If you knew the 10th moment, if the first 10 moments of your initial data, you can write down a formula for the 10th moment of the solution, which involved the 10th moment of the initial data plus all the others in some combination. Sometimes they were zero. And we derived that knowing the moments of the heat kernel. And here, no. We don't even see k in the first, in the zeroth moment. And to tell you the truth, we don't even see k in the first moment. I should have said that. Let's try the first moment. X w of x squared dx. That's the first moment. It's a vector. First moment of p, 0. And can you tell me what that is? 0 for any k. You don't even see the k. Yet you can make things go very fast according to that. Okay? And I just want to... It moves like a classical particle, yeah, but it's funny. I mean, this is explicit because of the k, but I mean, k is just a parameter, so that's a surprise, right? To me, it's a surprise. K is some number, but the center of this Gaussian, if one, you usually solve an equation and always find Gaussians. You find a solution, but it's not always a Gaussian. Here, it stays exactly a Gaussian and moves exactly like a classical particle. And a theorem from previous times say if I give you anything, it looks like a wave packet doesn't move exactly like a Gaussian. It looks like a continues to look a bit like a wave packet, but it moves at the group velocity here. It's exactly at the group velocity. It says it moves approximately at the group velocity here. It says it moves exactly at the group velocity. A vector. Sorry, a vector. K is d by dc of omega at k. Phase velocity. No. Yes, if you look very carefully in here, the peaks are moving through this at the phase velocity. In fact, this moves fast and the peaks move half as fast. So if you examine that formula, you see them moving half as fast. That's a stretch. I'm not sure. The uncertainty principle is more if you also measure its Fourier transform. Because you're looking at what's measured at two places in space. Unfortunately, those two commute. So I'm not sure. It's more like wave packet spreading, which is not quite Heisenberg, but it's still mystique of quantum mechanics, but not quite Heisenberg. Okay, I didn't want to say too much more on this, but I do have a couple more pages of notes, which is I want to say also a theorem, which is more mathematically precise. And that is, let's take preamble is it's related to this, that dpt of x is equal to the integral of c of x t squared dx for any solution c of x t. We have the following. Dpt, of course, that's equal to the integral of c0 of x. We proved this in two ways, which is the initial probability distribution, dp0. We also stated this in another way, which is the L2 norm is conserved, or you could say that the operator norm of the Schrodinger semigroup is bounded. In fact, it's equal to 1. And I want to say it's the operator norm taking L2 functions two L2 functions. So theorem two concerns that for p different than 2. So for any 1 less than or p equal to p, less than or equal to plus infinity, but p not equal to 2, the solution operator so the Schrodinger propagator S of t mapping LP to LP is not bounded. Isn't that interesting? So I'm following my usual practice, which is it's boring to have a sequence of definitions, and you probably already know what the operator norm means. But I'll just make sure by following that up with the definition, with a precise definition of what I mean by that. So definition of the operator norm. So do you need an LP space defined? No. Yes. Okay. Completeness. One. LP of R n equals the set of functions f, which are measurable, I guess. Let's say measurable functions, such that you take the pth power dx, and let's take the pth root, just to be nice, and I'll call that the LP norm, and that's a finite number, not infinity. And then the 2 is what I really wanted to define, which is what's the operator norm. So you have an operator Q, say, mapping LP space to, well, how about if I one Banach space to another? Banach space 1 to Banach space 2. And you can define its operator norm as, well, it doesn't have an operator norm. What I want to say, one defines the norm. By doing the following thing, you take Q of phi. Let's see, you take phi in the domain space, in the first space. But you don't want to divide by 0. I'm about to divide by something, so let's make this non-zero in the B1 norm. And I take what happens to Q in the B2 norm, what happens after applying Q, but you divide by where you were originally. And then you take the soup over this. Soup over this possibility. And that's, by definition, I guess this defines the operator norm. So it's by definition, it's Q, the operator norm. And it's very clumsy notation because you have to say where you're starting, B1, and you have to say where you're finishing. But I don't know any good replacements for that. Of course, if you didn't like doing the soup over all possible B1s, you could soup over all phi in B1, just divide by, since it's a linear operator, just make sure that the B1 norm of phi is equal to 1 of what Q does to phi. So just look at the image of the unit ball in the first Banach space and see how large it gets in the B2 space. Could be infinite, of course. And so theorem 2 says if you do that for p not equal to, you get infinity. The soup is infinity. Problem set problem. Plug in our solution and try it. So it's problem set number 11. Problem set 11. prove this theorem for S. It's a calculation. But since I don't know what you're, if you're handing in your problem, but since there was such silence when I talked about this solution and is it correct or not, first you have to adjust that solution to be correct, if it isn't already. And it's a little, I mean, it is a calculation, right? It's not, and then plug it in. Okay, but you should see it spreads, that should ruin things. Okay, the calculation. And I want to contrast that with the heat equation. So contrast. So we're coming back to the heat equation. Contrast this situation. Incidentally, this is a typical situation for a wave equation, where you propagate things and they're spreading. Measurable. I just was being careful. Just so you don't slip in a non-measurable function on me. If you don't believe in the axiom of choice, there isn't such. Okay? Contrast this situation, which is a wave type of equation, the Schrodinger equation, with the heat equation. Which has a kernel, h of x, t, equals 1 upon root 2 pi t to the n, e to the minus mod x squared over 2t. And we found that, well, we found that h of x, t was always greater than or equal to 0. So we found, and that you integrate h of x, t, dx, well, you integrate its L1 norm, but it's positive, so you don't even have to bother with the chalk to put the absolute values around it. And that's, in any case, that's the L1 norm, h of x, t. One way of writing the L norm, well, one norm, and we found is we normalized it to be 1. And then you solve the solution in general. So that's one thing we found, the second thing we found, and the third thing we found was we solved at least for L2 or maybe L1 or maybe LP initial data, we found solutions by convolution. So solutions, I didn't put down the heat equation, so let's put that down. D by DTU is equal to 1/2 of Laplacian U. Solutions, U of XT were given as convolutions, H of X minus Y, T, U0 of Y, dy. So this is the equation with initial data, u0 of x equals u, x at 0. So I want to now start talking about the LP estimates for the heat operator. And let's call the solution, remember we had the solution operator, this double line h of t. So let's look at, so that gives us theorem. Theorem 1, 2, 3. Theorem 3. Which is, for any 1 less than or equal to p less than or equal to plus infinity, the solution operator h of the heat equation is bounded on all LPs, on LP. For any of these Ps, it is bounded on LP with, you take the operator and you compute its operator norm, LP to LP, and it's equal to 1. Oh, I just had an idea, which is, this, of course, it's supposed to make everyone nervous, which is, remember there was a final exam? Terrible. It's a final exam. Maybe we should have that on the 25th. Well, so I had the idea. I had two ideas. I just had the second one right now. The first one was, it's a year's course. So maybe the final exam should be in May. But then it's bigger, but then it's further away. But I just had an idea that my final exam was always going to be a long problem set. And to tell you the truth, I was going to give a bunch of problems today. So let's just forego the final exam for the first semester. And it'll be, say, the problem set I give you this time and next. And I'll try to not give too many problems next time, but I do want to give you maybe two or three this time. Is that okay? People tend to do the problem sets, and people do tend to collaborate, but I think that's probably okay. Just as long as in a collaboration you learn something. Something substantial, at least something. Okay? Everyone agree? No one disagrees, at least. The room is quiet, but at least no one disagrees. Okay. So, I was going to prove a piece of this, but then I'm going to have you prove the other piece. Thanks. I'm going to give them the Young's inequality. No, I'm not going to. I'm going to give something a little bit even better. But there is Young's inequality coming up. So, let's see. So how do I want to do this? Here's what I want to do. I'm sorry, I'm not doing this optimally. Here's what I want to do. I'm going to give a proof. It's up to me, and I'm going to do that in a few moments. But I'm going to prove less than or equal to 1. And U, so that's problem set. Problem set number 11, problem 2. Show equal to 1. Okay? So that's problem set. This is problem number 1, and that's problem number 2. So, in order to prove theorem 3, I actually want to change sections. So, I want to move section to a section actually which I called in the syllabus something I want to call it integral inequalities. So now I want to work on section 2.8. So the proof of this fact is motivates a set of inequalities I want to. So now I'm moving into more analytic grounds. So this will be integral inequalities. So these are inequalities which govern embedding properties of common Banach spaces into each other. So they are involve relations between LP spaces and possibly other spaces. And possibly others. And as Vitaly has said, I'm going to work a few pages. I'm going to arrive at Young's inequality, and we're going to come back to the proof of theorem 3. Okay? When we get to Young's inequality, will be used for proof of theorem 3. So, and if you don't mind, I'm going to start out elementary. Because partly it gives me a chance to do things in a particular way, I guess. So, proposition 1 in integral identities, remember I'm always coming back to theorem 3, is really simple. and it has two parts. Let F be an LP of Rn, and G be an LP prime of Rn, with the classic duality relationship between P and P prime. So that is 1 upon P plus 1 upon P prime equals 1. All I'm doing is writing down the Hurwitz inequality. Then I can take F of X, multiply by G of X, iterate dx, take absolute value, can't be bigger than the LP norm of F times LP prime norm of G. I'm going to prove that here too, because why not? And then this has all P's. This works for 1 less than P and P prime less than infinity. And it doesn't work for 1 equal because I haven't defined what LP is. But LP for L infinity, I haven't defined what L infinity is, but L infinity, of course, is F L infinity is, of course, the soup or the essential soup of X and Rn. You're allowed to digress by sets of measure 0 of F of X. You're allowed to violate that number by on sets of measure 0, but not otherwise. And this is fits into this system by point 2, which is that if support of F is compact, then limit as P goes to infinity of F of LP is equal to F L infinity. So it's not true, of course, if you don't have compact support, but it has to do with how singular the function can be. And this is an interesting thing to see, that if F is in all, if F is in all the LP spaces and in L infinity, this holds. But remember, we also said that L infinity is not the intersection of LPs. So it's related a little bit to that idea. And these are absolutely classic real analysis propositions. No kidding. I'm going to leave this one to our faint memory of our real analysis. When's our last real analysis class? Anyway, faint echoes of that. We'll prove this one. Faint echoes of this, prove this one. But I'm too tempted to prove this one myself, just because it's fun geometrically. Okay? So I'm going to prove this. So proof of one. Just because it's fun. It's too tempting to leave it, so I have to. So let's do the following thing. First, let's establish a particular fact. So establish first that for A, B, two real numbers that are positive, that are non-negative, you can do the following thing. A times B is less than or equal to A to the P over P plus B to the P prime over P prime. As long as 1 over P plus 1 over P prime equals 1. And I guess I need 1 less than P and P prime, less than plus infinity, because I don't want to deal with which one, if 1 is infinity, what is the other one? I guess it works because you divide by infinity, but good enough. Let's do this case. But you know, there's a related inequality, which is even more general. Consider two convex functions. Phi of X and C of Y. Actually, I want them to satisfy two things. I want, for one, I want to normalize them. So phi of 0 is equal to 0, and also C of 0. Suppose we're in that situation. And much stronger, I want them to be convex duals of each other, which means the following thing, that their derivatives are their inverse functions. So, so if y is equal to phi prime of x, then x is equal to c prime of y. Then, for any a, b, non-negative, we have an inequality. So let's see. This is our 1. That's our formula 2 up there. I won't bring it down. So this is 3, and this is 4. And 4 says a times b is less than or equal to phi of a plus c of b. It's like that. And let's just check that this implies that. So what I need is phi of x, I want to be x to the p over p, and c of y, I'm going to say is y to the p prime over p prime. And now let's see, I need phi prime of x is equal to x to the p minus 1 equals y. And now let's check this. C prime of y is equal to y to the p prime minus 1 is equal to x. And this works when p minus 1 is equal to 1 over p prime minus 1. Isn't that right? Which I guess means that which means p is equal to 1 over p prime minus 1 plus 1, which is equal to one plus p prime minus 1 over p prime minus 1, cancel the 1s, is equal to p prime over p prime minus 1. But that's the famous relation between that's essentially this, right? So this 4 implies 3. So what we have to do is prove 4. So there's a perfect little slot on the blackboard in which to prove 4. And I'm going to prove it by drawing a picture. So here's y, and here's x. And I'm going to draw a graph not of phi, but of phi prime. Okay, so this is a phi prime. It's increasing, meaning phi is convex. But it can be wiggly, I guess. Not in our case, but it is wiggly. And now let's do the following thing. Let's take A here. So this is y is equal to phi prime of x, and because of those inverse things, that says c prime of y is equal to x, because of being convex duals. Okay, and now let's look at a here. Well, the integral of phi prime of x between 0 and a is phi of x minus phi of 0, but phi of 0 is 0. So the area equals phi of a. You agree with me? Let's do the same for B. Choose a B here. The area equals C of D. You agree with me? And AB is this subarea, and that's excess. There we are. Now I have to erase a bit. So I have to now do the integral inequality, right? Because I've just been fooling around in the plane. So let's do the following thing. I have f times g integral dx absolute value. That has something to do with the left-hand side of the Hurwitz inequality. So first thing we just notice is that obviously the absolute value of a sum is less than the sum of the absolute values because of it doesn't allow cancellation. So here's f of x times g of x dx. And so, in fact, in all of these inequalities, we could, without loss of generality, in these sort of inequalities, we don't really count on cancellation. We could just have assumed, just as well assumed f of x greater than or equal to 0 and g of x greater than or equal to 0. Because the first thing you do is take the absolute value of everything, and then you go. Okay? So you can just put the absolute value inside and go, basically. Okay? And now here's A, here's B, so that's less than or equal to the integral of 1 upon P, F to the P, plus 1 upon P prime, G to P prime, dx. And now let's first say that, in fact, F, the LP norm, is not just finite, it's equal to 1. And also G, the LP prime norm, is equal to 1. Just do it on the unit ball first. And therefore, this right-hand side is equal to the pth power of the pth norm times 1 upon P, plus the same with P prime, which is equal to 1. So we've proved the Hurwitz inequality for on the unit ball. That's less than or equal to 1. Of course, the general case follows right away because we would rather study f of x over the LP norm of f times g of x over the LP prime norm of g, and those both have length 1 dx. We've just decided that this is less than or equal to 1, and then we multiply through. So we're done. Okay, that's fun. But actually, I wanted to talk about the heat equation, and so we don't need that. But what we do need is inequalities involving convolution. So we need something slightly more than these simple integral identities, so inequalities involving convolution. So, so let's see, I really want to go to the heat equation, which is now under the blackboard, and I want to talk about estimating U of T in terms of LP norms of H and LP norms of the initial data. Okay? So here's the major one, which Vitaly already mentioned, which is theorem, and I forget where I am on this now. Proposition 1, so theorem 2. Ah, sure. Theorem 2, which is the famous Young's inequality. Which I guess goes as follows. Let's let h of x, I want that to be an L1 function. All right, and I'll explain why in a minute. Then, for all 1 less than or equal to p less than or equal to plus infinity, the following inequality holds. I'll say we have, and f in LP, we have the following thing. You take the convolution of f with h, and you measure it in LP space, and it's bounded by a constant which is 1 times h and L1 f and LP. And there's an immediate corollary which is of interest to us, which is the heat propagator, so the heat flow operator is bounded on all LP spaces. 1 less than or equal to p less than or equal to plus infinity. And so let's at least prove the corollary, then we'll have a break. Well, solution is a convolution. So as I've been saying, solution is given by a convolution. So u of xt is equal to the integral of a kernel h of x minus y t. What's our initial data? U0 of y dy, integrate over all Rn. And let's measure it in the LP norm. So what's the u xt measuring in LP? This is a space norm, right? T is a parameter. T is a curve parameter in our space. And that is equal to, well, the heat flow T operating on u0 of x. And we're measuring it in LP space. And our theorem says that this is a convolution. So our theorem says, sorry, the Young's inequality says that I'm supposed to take the L1 norm of the heat kernel. That heat kernel is hx of t, L1 norm, times the LP norm of u0. And now I conveniently calculated the L1 norm of the heat kernel on the blackboard here that's hidden. It's 1. Oh, so I'll leave this down for a second. Is that okay? So I've just shown you that this is less than or equal to 1 times u0. And if I do that little calculation saying what's the operator norm, so here's that heat kernel, this is a double line. You have to keep track of this is the operator. HT operator norm, and I guess I'm going from LP to LP, is equal to sup over all possible u0s in LP. That's the starting space, and the final space is also LP. I can say this, all u0s not equal to 0 of a ratio of HT acting on u0 LP divided by u0 LP. So that's less than or equal to sup of all that stuff down there of, we have a bound for this, 1 times u0 of p, the sup of 1. And so what I've shown you is that this less than equal to sign. And what your problem set is to show that it's in fact equal. Any suggestions on how you would do that? equality. You might try to get a function. Find a function which you get equality. Well, you could either find a function that's a soup. So you find a sequence of function which moves up below. But actually, you can find a function which gets exactly equality. Which function do you think you should get? It's not an LP. It's not a good one. That would be a sequence underneath it. Why not the heat kernel? That's perfectly a good LP function for every P. Put it in. See what happens. Okay, so now I've stated the theorem, and I've stated the corollary, and I proved it, and I contrast with the Schrodinger equation, where none of them are bounded in LP. But then we have a break, and I'm going to come back and prove that Young's inequality. Good. We're now moving on to where did we stop? Proof of Young's inequality. So that's this inequality. So let's start with two special cases. P equals 1, and then P equals infinity. And let's just check those two. So let F and H be an L. So we'll do the first one. Let F and H be an L1. Now remember my comment, in these inequalities, the first thing you do is you put absolute, there's no cancellation involved. The first thing you do is you put absolute values on anything before carrying on. So let's save chalk by agreeing they're already positive. If they aren't, the first thing you're going to do is take the absolute values and then reduce it to the positive case. Okay, so F and H are an L1, and let's make them without loss of generality. F and H are both non-negative. Now I have to study H convolved with F in L1. And that's going to be equal to, of course, the integral of the absolute value of the integral of H of X minus Y, F of Y, dy, absolute value, dx. And I just violated my principles, but I guess I'm doing this pedagogically. If H is positive and F is positive, their product is positive, their sum is positive, the sum of that is positive. So you don't even need those absolute value signs. Use Fubini. So use Fubini's theorem to interchange integrations. Y is on the inside, I want now Y to be on the outside. So I'm going to have integral of H of X minus Y, F of Y, dy on the outside, but this doesn't depend on X, so I'm going to put dx on the inside. And performing the X integration, that's invariant under translation, I'm going to get, and H is positive, so I could perfectly well, so that's the L1 norm of H, so that's HL1. And what remains is the integral of Fy dy, which is the L1 norm of F, because, again, F is positive. And I also want to note, Young's inequality is an equality in L1 for positive functions. Young is an equality. We've just proved it. On L1 for H and F positive, non-negative. If they go negative, then there can be some cancellations, and maybe they're not an equality anymore, but it turns out to it's an equality. So that's the P equals 1 case. How about P equals infinity? That was P equals 1 case. P equals infinity case. Well, I guess I'm supposed to look at F H L infinity, which is the soup or essential soup over X and Rn of the absolute value of integral of H of X minus Y. Remember, this is a commutative product, dy. Oh, that reminds me of another thing I wanted to say. Note, that's one comment. I had another comment, which is, if H is an L1 and F is an L1, then the result is L1. So not only in L1 can you add and scalar multiply, and multiply by scalars, but there's a product between two L1 functions, which is a commutative product, which is, so that's a way of saying is that L1 is an algebra under, well, there's plus, of course, but there's also the product given by the convolution. One of those things. Makes things easy sometimes. Back to L infinity. So let's take the essential soup of this thing, which I guess is less than or equal to essential soup to always on the outside. And I can dispense with the absolute value signs because everything, because that's positive a priori. So I can take h of x minus y inside, but if I don't take f of y but take its essential soup at every point, I only get bigger. And that allows me to write this as somewhat superfluously the essential soup x and Rn. The integral of h of x minus y, this is a constant, dy times f the L infinity norm. And this, of course, we see is h the L1 norm. So that is for positive functions, and you sprinkle absolute value signs at the appropriate places for any function. So we've done p equals 1, p equals infinity. For 1 less than p, less than plus infinity, what does 1 do? There are several routes. One very slick and rapid route is you use an interpolation, like a Riesz, what's often called, a very simple interpolation called the Riesz-Thorin interpolation. So one route. But the Fourier transform doesn't act so nicely on LP spaces. L2 is good, but LP spaces are a little bit more uncomfortable. So, but one route is through interpolation. So Riesz-Thorin interpolation. But in fact, I don't want to take that route this time. There's also a direct route. So that'll do it a little in a few less lines. But it's more fun to do things directly. So we won't take that route. So another way, maybe nicer, is it's self-contained and uses the Hölder inequality. So I want to look as follows. Again, without loss of generality, we're having h and f greater than or equal to 0. Otherwise, we would do everything with absolute value signs. First step would be to say that this convolution product is bounded of by the convolution product of the absolute values of the two functions, and then carry on. Okay? So then, let's do the following thing. H convolve with f of x is equal to the integral of h of x minus y, f of y, dy. And what I want to say is, this is equal to the integral of the h of 1 upon p, x minus y, f of y, times h of 1 upon p prime of x minus y dy. Because 1 upon p plus 1 upon p prime is equal to 1. And now, let's bound this above. Here's an integral with two factors. Let's use Hölder. So less than or equal to integral. And let's use p and p prime. So it's f. F is 1 power, so now I get f to the p of y times h to 1 over p to the p, so I get h of x minus y dy, but I have to take a pth root. That's the first factor. The second factor is integral of h of x minus y to 1 over p prime power to the p prime power, that's 1, dy to the 1 over p prime. And this is equal to, of course, the convolution of f to the p convolved with h. Whoops, convolved with h. And then after you do that, you take 1 of the pth power. And it's a function of x, by the way. But this is not a function of x. This is simply the h 1 over pth p prime power of L1. from that, right? And the result is still a function of x. I haven't really taken an LP norm yet or anything. So now let's take the LP norm of, well, of the left-hand side. I want to take the LP norm of my convolution. All I've done is made an upper bound as a function of x of the convolution. Now let's take the LP norm of the convolution. So take LP norm. I'm going to get H convolved with F LP norm dx. So that's the pth power of the LP norm. I haven't taken the pth root yet. So it's less than or equal to, let's see, the LP norm of this. Well, there's a 1 over p power, so I take it to the pth power, cancels the power, and I integrate. So integral of FP convolution H, I don't need the absolute value sign, sorry, of x dx. That's the pth power of that LP norm. And then there's the constant out and back, which is H, the L1 norm. We had a 1 over p prime's power, and now I just took it to a pth power. And the LP norm of the whole thing is the pth root of the left-hand side and of the right-hand side. And now there's a number on the left and a number on the right. And so let me just do something with the something on the left, which is now F to the P, F is an LP, so F to the P is an L1. So now we use the L1 result. And we use it on this to say that that's, in fact, less than or equal to F to the pth power in L1 times H in L1 times H in P over P prime. So L1, that was the constant that was left behind. Which is, of course, that L1 norm of F to the P is the LP norm of F to the pth power. So this is equal to F LP norm to the pth power, and now I do all these H's. H L1 to how many powers? 1 plus P over P prime. And that's, I'll just write down what the left-hand side is. It's H convolved with F LP norm to the pth power. And now let's just take the pth root. Oh, people who take meticulous notes hate this because it's so easy with an eraser. And of course, 1 upon p plus 1 upon p prime. So that's the result. Yeah, I didn't, when I wrote this down, I didn't transpose that inequality. There we are. Yes? I have to think about that for a sec. Certain things don't work. This seems to work. This seems to work because you're really just taking the p norms of the p norms of p throughs of the kernel, etc. But that would be a very important point. Let's see. You put this out here and this here, and you just rewrite that. Oh, and then this is a Hurler inequality. So, in fact, this is just rewriting the function. No, I think he survives. But we can discuss it later. It's, there are a number of things that really rely on translation, but maybe not here. Okay, so think about it, and we'll discuss it afterwards. You have a comment? It's terrible to do things like that. After doing these calculations, we found this had a p power, this had a p power, and this is 1 plus p over p prime. This is the pth power of the LP norm. This is the pth power of the LP norm. And this was H L1 times 1 plus p over p prime. And I took the pth root of everything. And I used the fact that pth root, and pth root. And then I said, oh, here's the exponent, which is this. So it's 1. So that's the inequality. which brings to mind, how do you choose these funny relations between things? So we have 1 upon p plus 1 upon p prime equals 1. We've seen it come up twice already. And what I want to say is that's obviously not arbitrary. And there's a way where you should understand that that comes up more than some complicated convex analysis on a blackboard long ago. So what I want to talk about in a small section is on dimensional analysis. And I want that to go to say that it's following, that it's a scaling argument. And scaling arguments rarely prove theorems, but you can use them to disprove theorems. Often, it will choose to, for you the appropriate exponents in a possibly complicated argument or possibly complicated inequality, but then by some other means you have to prove it. But you can certainly say what will not happen, what will not occur. So I want to say, so you use it for counterexamples, maybe is the way to say that. So what I want to do is, suppose you have a, suppose you have an inequality. I don't want to say something arbitrary, but I want to say, suppose we have a, so I want to illustrate by saying, suppose we have, an inequality, and I'm going to make, for my inequality, we've just been talking about convolution inequalities, so let's say I want to measure that in the convolution product in HP, and suppose I wanted to try to measure this in terms of H LQ F LP. Is this possible? Well, we've shown it, it's possible for Q equals 1, but maybe it's possible for other Q. Shall we try it? So let's ask if this would be true. Ask if this is true. But of course, if it's true, it has to be true over all possible functions in LP, LQ space. So what I want to do is give a simple family of functions with which to test. So I test it with not h, but h sub alpha of x, which is simply h of alpha x. And of course, you should also test with f sub alpha of x. And that will say the following thing. That will say that, is it true that h sub alpha convolution f sub alpha, and I'll take alpha, any alpha in real, so if I'm just looking at a one parameter family of samples, has to be true for everything, so how about this one parameter family? And a little bit important that we're on Rn. So I can take a function and dilate the variables, and it's still defined on your domain, because the domain is dilation invariant. Otherwise, you might have to only go in one direction, squinching your... Okay, so but we're giving an Rn argument. Okay, so I have to now test whether H alpha convolution product F alpha measured in LP, and let's see if we can bound it above by LQ LP. So let's write that down. It's integral, absolute value, integral f of alpha x, because that's what f alpha is, alpha y, h of alpha x minus y, dy, l p norm, p power, dx, close 1 upon p power. And we're asking, is this less than or equal to integral f alpha x alpha y alpha x, say, to the pth power dx to the 1 upon pth power times h, so h of alpha x, h alpha, so h alpha x to the, what did I say, the q power dx to the 1 upon q. And the question is, could this be true? That's what we're trying. So clearly what we're to do is take that expression, change variables. Change variables. So in the left-hand side and in the right-hand side. So my variables, of course, are going to be x prime is equal to alpha x, and y prime is equal to alpha y. So I'm going to write down the left-hand side. So that says integral, absolute value, integral, f of alpha y. So that's f of y prime, h of alpha x minus y, h of x prime minus y prime, dy. Dy is alpha to the minus n, dy prime. Close. Pth power. Dx. Alpha to the minus n, dx prime. Close. The 1 upon pth power. That's the left-hand side. And I want to ask, is that bounded, always bounded, above by a constant? I made that constant 1. Which, you know, we could even speculate, is it bounded by a constant? Let's do that. Sorry for the notes. Is there a constant such that that works? Is there a constant such that this works? Maybe it wouldn't be 1, then we'd leave us speculating. So let's try a constant. Is it bounded by a constant times the right-hand side? So the first term is integral. Absolute value of f. Alpha x is x prime. P power. Alpha to the minus n, dx prime, right? Same as before. To the pth root times integral. H to the x prime to the q. Alpha to the minus n, dx prime to the 1 upon q. And now all these things, this, this, and this, differ from this, this, and this, by powers of alpha. So let's pull those out. So is it true that alpha, to pull it out, this is alpha to the minus n to the p to the 1 over p. So it's alpha to the minus n. But this times alpha to the minus n to 1 over p. So alpha to the minus n over p times some number, which is the, what was it? The f convolved with h LP norm. That's what that is. Take the alphas out. This is f convolved with h, not f alpha convolved with h alpha. That's how it scales. And question, is it less than or equal to c times, how about the alphas here? I have alpha to the minus n over p. Alpha to the minus n over p. And here I have an alpha to the minus n over q times the right-hand side. F LP H LQ. Can this hold for all constants? For a given constant, can this hold if I'm allowed to change alpha among all real numbers? It could only hold if the exponents matched. Can only hold if we're in a situation where alpha to the minus n times 1 plus 1 upon p is equal to alpha to the minus n times 1 upon p plus 1 upon q. So that way, this exponent would be equal to this exponent. Otherwise, you would change alpha. You would say, well, does it work for this constant? You change alpha to ruin the constant. Okay, so it has to be that those two terms cancel, or else the inequality is not true. Well, this forces q equal 1. So this simple argument says that the Young's inequality is the only inequality of that form that can hold in terms of balancing LP of F and LQ on H. But of course, it's not the only inequality. There are other combinations, but we have to change all exponents, right? So I want to do that. That's the extended Young's inequality. But actually, while I'm doing this, just to stress its simplicity but its importance, let's just try the Hölder inequality. So I have to integrate f alpha x g alpha x dx, and I want to know, can this be less than or equal to f l p g l q? Which p and q? Okay, so let's try it. What I'm going to do is say that this is equal to the integral of f of x prime, g of x prime, alpha to the minus n, dx prime, right? And this, oh, sorry, I have to have alphas here. And this is equal to, right, it's equal to, let's see, the integral of f to the x prime, because f alpha of x is f to the x prime to the p alpha to the minus n dx prime 1 upon p, right? That's that. Times, now we do the g, which is integral g of x prime to the q alpha to the minus n dx prime to the 1 upon q, right? And we say that this is equal to, of course, alpha to the minus n absolute value of f g dx. And this is equal to alpha to the minus n upon p minus n upon q. F L P G L Q. Isn't that right? And the question is, does that hold? Even with any other constant, does that hold? And the answer is only when. When the minus n is equal to minus n times 1 upon p plus 1 upon q. So this forces 1 is equal to 1 upon p plus 1 upon q. That is, q is equal to p prime. That's the only Hölder inequality you can have, at least in Rn. So let me go on to the extended Young's inequality. And the first thing we're going to do is use this principle to choose the exponent. Let's see. So the question is can you find an inequality which is f convolved with h? Sometimes I write f convolved with h, and sometimes I write h convolved with f, but it commutes, it's a commutative product. So can we find f convolved with LR, say, less than or equal to a constant times f LP times h LQ? Can we find an inequality like that? The first thing we're going to do is choose what's the relationship between R, P, and Q. So on the left-hand side, we've done this a bunch. We'll do it one more time. Integral, absolute value, integral F of alpha X minus Y, H of alpha Y, DY to the Rth power. That's the Rth power of the convolution product. DX. Close, 1 upon r. That's the left-hand side. And we've already done this a zillion times, so I'm going to leave this question mark there, and we're going to say the constant. And now if we put f alpha, h alpha, we got a power, some product, some alphas, some powers of alpha here. We just did that in this argument with Hölder. It's a product of two LP norms. We're going to get an n upon p and n upon q. Minus n upon p minus n upon q. So it's c times alpha to the minus n upon p minus n upon q times f lp g lq. Isn't that right? And now what we have to do is just inspect what happens here. So this is equal to integral f of x prime minus y prime h of y prime alpha to the minus n dy prime closed to the rth power alpha to the minus n dx prime 1 upon r. And so now we have to extract all the alphas. So it's going to be equal to f convolved with h, the LR norm, times alpha to a certain power. Here's alpha to the minus Rn, 1 upon r. So it's alpha to the minus n. Here's alpha to the minus n upon r, minus n upon r. When does this match this? It matches when 1 plus 1 upon r is equal to 1 upon p plus 1 upon q. How about that? So we can now state our theorem. We've deduced what the the extended Young's inequality is before we even state what the inequality is. If you ever forget, this is easier than remembering the proof, by the way. So, let's see. Theorem 4. And this is the extended Young's inequality. And I guess it goes as far like this. We take 1 less than or equal to p, q, and r less than or equal, they're allowed to be infinity. But we need one relation, and that's given by the scaling. 1 plus 1 upon r is equal to 1 upon p plus 1 upon q. If it weren't that, we would be putting in a counterexample. Right? We would instead of saying inequality, we'd say counterexample. Let's take those exponents. Then, if you measure the convolution product in LR, you can bound it above by a constant F in LP, H in LQ. And a proof. Just thinking of the material I have left. So the things I want to do, but I've run out of time, are to prove the inequality and then show decay estimates for the heat equation using the generalized Young's inequality. So let's see how it should go. Well, it makes sense to finish the inequality now and next week, and then we can go off through lunch and prove the estimates for the heat equation, estimates for the Schrodinger equation, estimates for the wave equation, and about 4 p.m. we can stop. How about if I prove the theorem next time? We'll do estimates for the heat equation between LP, LQ, and then estimates for the Schrodinger equation between LP and LQ. The problem with our unboundedness is we insisted it's the same P for the Schrodinger equation. Okay? So that'll keep with the theme, okay? And time will enter, so we'll see that you can show that solutions decay in time when measured in an LP space. Okay, so let's do the proof. I want to actually mention an easy generalization of the Hölder inequality. And that goes as follows. I want to integrate f of x times g of x times h of x dx. bounded above by F P1, F, how about if I do this? Yeah, F of P1, G of P2, H of P3.
What should the relation between P1, P2, and P3 be?
Well, one, yes, 1 upon P, with, well, 1 of P1 plus 1 upon P2 plus 1 upon P3 equals 1. Really, I guess I had this moment's hesitation because I really should say it's a, it's the following thing, product of Fj of x, j equals 1 to some capital N, dx, is bounded above by a product, j equals 1 to N, of the Fj, all measured in LPj norms, where sum 1 upon Pj, j equals 1 to N, is equal to 1. And if you want to find the exponents, what do you do? Hopefully I've brainwashed you so far. Do dimensional analysis. So I'm not going to prove this. You can prove it by induction, maybe, if you wanted. Or you can even prove it by, remember that inequality between A and B in the plane? Well, we'll prove an analogous inequality in N space between A1, A2, A3, up to AN. And then do something. In any case, you can prove it by induction. So let's, secondly, let's look at the convolution in the following form. The number of dimensions you need for that argument is related to the number of factors you have. If I have two factors, I look in the plane.
Okay, so those two factors are moving to our dimensions.
No, the dimension is not the dimension of space. The dimension is the number of factors you have, because, you know, A is the value of F, and B is the value of G, and C is the value of H, and D is, you know. That way you can go up to 26 dimensions.
It's a different question.
Different question. Yeah, you'd think string theory has something to do with the alphabet, with the Latin alphabet as interpreted by the Americans. Maybe the British, too. Where was I? I want to use this inequality. Actually, I only want to use three. That's why I had the 3 down, but I thought I should merely state its generalization in the following form. So integral of f of y, h of x minus y, dy. Oh, and we're going to do the thing is without loss of generality, f and h are non-negative. Otherwise, the first thing you do is say, oh, it's bounded above by their absolute values, and then I'm going to study their absolute values. And I want to write this in, you have to be a little, just a little clear-headed here to get the exponents right. I want to say f of y, I want to take that to the a power, h of x minus y, I want to take that to a b power. Which means there are powers left. H of x minus y, there's, started out with one power, so I'm allowed 1 minus b, and there's f of y, 1 minus a, dy. That's convolution product. And now I'm going to say that it's less than or equal to integral f of y to the a power. I'm going to look at this as one of the factors, but I'm going to take that to the r power, dr. Oh, sorry. But I want this also to the r power, so h of x minus y to the br. This one I'm taking to the r. This is my three factors: 1, 2, 3. And the first one is to the b power, dy to the 1 upon r. This is going to be a pointwise estimate of the convolution product, right? F convolve with h, the function of x. is equal to that, I'm trying to find how big is it in terms of LP norms of other things. Okay, so it's equal to this. Then I'm going to have the h. So let's see, h. So it's the integral of h of x minus y dy. And I'm going to, let me just say this, the following thing. It's rho times 1 minus b. I'll figure out what rho is, because then it has to be 1 upon rho. And I'm going to do the same with f. F y to the 1 minus a. And I'm running out of letters, so sigma dy to the 1 minus sigma. Now, to make the powers r, rho, and sigma work out for Hölder, generalized Hölder, I need 1 upon rho plus 1 upon sigma plus 1 upon r. That has to add to 1. Okay? Now, let's make the choices. So now we have to choose things. R is going to be given. That's part of our theorem. We haven't seen P and Q yet, so let's be wise about choices. So let's choose. Let's choose A times R. And I want that to be equal to P. B times R is equal to Q. And rho is equal to, let's see, Q over 1 minus B. Sigma is equal to P over 1 minus A. I think this works. So that I have the following thing. The integral of the absolute value, I guess I don't need that. Integral of f y h of x minus y dy. That's the convolution product. Absolute value to the rth power. That's the r power of the LR norm, dx. So I took the r power of this thing, and I integrated dx. It's less than or equal to the r power of this, just gives me that integral. Integral, absolute value, integral of f to the p, y, h to the q of x minus y, dy, close, dx, that's that factor, times, well, what do I have here? I have the dy, these are just numbers, according to this estimate, and I've figured out rho, so that rho times 1 minus b is equal to q. So this is h l q norm to the r times I took an r power, so I took an r power, so it's, I guess it's r over rho. And then this is a f to the 1 minus a sigma. Let's see, 1 minus a sigma is equal to the p norm. It looks p. And then it's r over sigma. And then use our results on L1. Use our L1 result, which says this is less than or equal to, here's a convolution between f to the p, h to the q. So it's less than, it's the same stuff we did before, f lp to the p-th power, h lq to the q-th power, that's that first factor, times h LQ, and I have r over rho, and then we just work out that r over rho is r minus q, and times f to the LP, r over sigma is r minus p. And let's see how that, if that works right. Then the rth power of the LP norm of the product is bounded by f, the LP norm of f to the p times F to the R minus P, so it's LP norm of F to the Rth power. And H LQ norm to the Q times H LQ norm to the R minus Q is H LQ norm to the R. And then I take an Rth root. And I went fast through the exponents. Check them. So we're done. But check your exponents. And I'm going to stop here. I'm already a little over time. So, very simple. It's all really as basic as the Hurler inequality plus Fubini's theorem.